It is again time for the new American Dream radio show. The American Russian novel, All We Need Is More Vodka radio album. We have the winds of our own totalitarian society freezing the land solid, a tortured tundra.
What we must have is a new American dream. We are allowed to ask any questions that we have. There are no wrong questions. A new American dream. Not of homes and toasters, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. The new America, the real hope of the world.
Some of those who have spoken the truth are no longer here. Their chairs at the Thanksgiving adult big table are empty. Their relatives have sent them to Siberia with a roll of their eyes. So let us begin. Here we go. Scooch up to the samovar. Maybe leave your hat and boots on. Fill your peasant hands with a warm drink. And listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
One type of song that's come into increasing prominence in recent years is the folk song of protest. You have to admire people who sing these songs. It takes a certain amount of courage to get up in a coffee house or a college auditorium or an open mic night and come out in favor of the things that everybody else in the audience is against, like peace and justice and brotherhood and so on. Nicest thing about a protest song is it makes you feel so good. I have a song here which I realize should be accompanied on a folk instrument, in which category singing a cappella does not, alas, qualify. So just imagine the guitar strumming in the background. We are the folk song army. Every one of us cares. We all hate poverty, war, and injustice, unlike the rest of you squares. There are innocuous folk songs, but we regard them with scorn. The folks who sing them have no social conscience. They don't even care if Jimmy cracked corn. If you feel dissatisfaction, strum your frustrations away. Some people may prefer action, but give me a folk song any old day. The tune don't have to be clever. It don't matter if you put a couple extra syllables into a line. Sounds more ethnic if it ain't good English, and it don't even got a rhyme. Rhyme. Remember the war against Franco, that's a kind where each of us belongs. Though we may have won all the battles, we had all the good songs. So join in the folk song army, guitars are the weapons we bring. To the fight against poverty, war, and injustice, ready, aim, sing. Thanks to the great Tom Lehrer for that one. I thought we needed a little levity tonight. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's listener-supported radio, and a new month means a new funding goal. So head over there right away and show them some love. freedomslips.com or revolution.radio. I am proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome these special guests. Ava Bird, Mickey Z, Evie Litwak, Frank Cordero, and Phil Ferruggio. So this Thursday evening we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, reasonably close to Duluth, Minnesota, in Los Angeles, in Des Moines, Iowa, in Port Orange, Florida, in New York City, and wherever you are.
And our first guest of the evening is Philip Ferruggio. He's coming to us from Port Orange. I spoke to him earlier, and here he is with It's the Empire, Stupid.
All right. Good evening, Working Stiffs. Stooge time for America.
You know, what one recalls when in the late 70s they rebroadcast the reruns of the Three Stooges comedy show. All the aficionados of the show would shout out, "It's Stooge time!" Well, sadly, after the latest school shooting in Florida, it is Stooge time again. The February 19th USA Today piece was carried, written by Brett Murphy, the reporter, and they relegated it to page 4 when it should have been on page 1. But the story was well written. It did cover the chain of actions and non-actions by the state agencies, the Sheriff's Department, and the FBI regarding the horrific actions of Nicholas Cruz. It was revealed to me as being downright disgusting. And please note that much of the information I'm going to relate to you comes sometimes word for word from that article. We now know that Cruz was diagnosed with depression, autism, and ADHD, and that he was cited for violence, fighting, assaults, profane language, and insults at school at least 41 times from 2012 to 2017 by teachers, school officials, and administrators. In May of 2016, a Florida Department of Children and Families investigator wrote, and I quote, "Mr. Cruz stated he plans to go out and buy a gun," unquote. That was 6 months before he turned 18 and legally did go out and buy one. And then the investigator said, quote, "It is unknown what he is buying the gun for," unquote. Police have acknowledged to visiting his home dozens of times, and there is no indication what actions, if any, the officers took. Of course, it is now public knowledge that while our fastidious FBI is hot on the case of some fat cat Russians allegedly hacking into the DNC and the Clinton campaign, they were called in January by a concerned citizen stating that Cruz has stated his desire to kill people online. We now know, and the FBI has had to apologize after the murders, that nothing was done about it. There were no visits to Cruz by the FBI, no interviews of him by the FBI. Going back to 2016, the Department of Children and Families investigator was told that Cruz was self-mutilating himself, a reason that the Florida Baker Act law could have been used to involuntarily get him the mental health evaluation he needed. At the same time, the investigator became concerned about Cruz's talk about being depressed and wanting to purchase a gun. Oh, boy. Now, here's the kicker. The investigators for that department noted that his mental health diagnosis and his expressions of hates, such as Nazi symbols on his book bag, alongside of a racial slur. When an investigator then went to visit Cruz at his home from the Department of Children and Families, there was no search to confirm these self-mutilations because, to quote the investigator, he was wearing long sleeves. The story gets even more disgraceful. The school staff, doing their jobs in October of 2016, called Henderson Behavioral Health in Broward County after learning that Cruz had self-mutilated himself and had a fight with another student. It was noted that Henderson's mobile crisis unit had been called out to the school and determined that he was not at risk to harm himself or others. The Henderson crisis clinician treating Cruz found him, quote, "stable enough not to warrant hospitalization under the Florida Baker Act for people who pose a threat to themselves or others." By the way, according to the reporter of USA Today, an administrator at Henderson declined to answer questions and hung up when contacted for an interview this Sunday before the article. Children and Families Department Secretary, this is another genius, Mike Carroll, said in a statement this is a couple of weeks ago, quote, "mental health services and supports were in place when this investigation closed." Oh, really, Mike? Thank goodness it wasn't your kids or your grandkids in the school that day. There's more to share the Stooge time here, folks. Let's not let the police off the hook completely either. Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel said 2 weeks ago, that his office received about 20 calls in the past few years about Cruz. That is not what some of the neighbors told the reporter. They felt that the number of 20 times over the past few years was much too low. A few said that deputies were frequently parked at Cruz's home, and one neighbor, Dave Brugman, called the sheriff's department after seeing Cruz post online about buying guns just after his 18th birthday, around the same time as the Children's and Families investigation of Cruz. Brugman said, "They told us they checked it out." And then he added that they told him, "You can't watch him every day." So we have an obviously mentally ill young man for not months, but years, who obviously needed continuous psychiatric treatment and close supervision. And here's the final kicker. Yes, all those in positions that we, the public, rely on had failed. If that was because we lived in a society whereupon the cherished safety net was well-funded and serviced by full staffing and lower caseloads, then the target of blame is obvious. Sadly, that is not the case. And of course, not ever mentioned by the USA Today reporter. Look how many homeless people walk the streets of all our towns. Does anyone connect the dots and realize that many of these folks are mentally ill and need institutional help? Of course, many of the others are low-income folks from dysfunctional backgrounds with little or no family or friend support. They are the ones who, quote, fall through the rocks of this top-heavy economic system we are submitted to live under. As far as a mentally ill homeless, I would say that if Nicholas Cruz did not use that gun and pull that trigger, he himself, with what little funding and staffing there currently is for the safety net, would probably be one of that army of the homeless walking the streets of Parkland. Our states and cities are broke. The military-industrial empire makes sure that over half of your tax money goes down the rabbit hole for unnecessary military spending, phony wars, and occupations with over 1,000 bases overseas and countries that do not want us there. Children like Nicholas Cruz, who are mentally ill, will continue to be pushed along by agencies that don't have the resources or the staffing to really stop this madness until the next trigger is pulled. Thank you.
My recommended for tonight, recent articles published on the Parkland school shooting at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. The March issue of Penn Magazine is now published online, Penn Magazine, P-E-N-N, magazine.us. Because we have lived in the United States of America for years and years and decades, we realize that when something like the Parkland school shooting occurs, we must inherently question the account given of the event by our government and our media, because they have demonstrated time and time again they are totally untrustworthy. But today, we are talking about Bigfoot and aliens, and at least we know they are real. Welcome to the March edition of Penn Magazine, P-E-N-N magazine.us.
And now we join in progress another episode of The Americans. Well, the nuts have returned to the big White House from the ping pong Winter Olympics to find cardboard boxes pretty much everywhere. President Cosmo and First Lady Imelda are supposed to host the annual Cherry Blossom Festival later this month, but because they have to go bowling, they will not be able to attend. And so Cosmo is calling for a $ Boobs and Tanks Festival in its place to be held this weekend. And right this moment, he's sitting down with special White House special events planner Robert Mueller to design a special T-shirt for the event this weekend, designed by the president himself. Red $ Boobs and Tanks nestled in the branches of a cherry tree. Cosmo and Imelda Nutt barely noticed the cardboard secrets box's mess. After designing the T-shirt, Cosmo said hi to Fred, the maintenance man of secrets, and the shirt with the Ralph name tag sitting in the kitchen with an ice pack on his forehead. Cosmo and Imelda only had a little time. They had to wash their bowling shirts and hop on Air Force One after the Dollar Signs, Boobs, and Tanks Festival to head to Dayton for the next stop on the American Yahoo's Doubles Bowling Tour, representing their sponsor, Ali's House of Jihad. Right away, the scrubbing began on all floors of the big White House to get the paint off the buttocks of Rasty the Patsy, Muhammad Ali the terrorist, Jews the limo driver, Slappy the house alien, Mama Pajama Jemima the MK Ultra trainer, Warren Beatty the secretary of getting things right, and Morgan Freeman, secretary of the War of the Worlds. All the Red Devils and Sickles and Hammers and Stalin and Lenin and Boris and Natasha and the Kremlin freshly painted on their behinds for the poop riot psyop to get the world to hate Russia that never really got off the ground. After the child left behind faced down the Bradley tank, all the tanks turned around and left, leaving the child left behind and Skippy the construction worker and self-taught on YouTube demolition expert sitting on the curb, going through all the boxes of secrets they were letting loose into the air. "Here's one that's still all taped up," said Skippy, bringing the cardboard box over to set it between them. "Must be a new one," said the child left behind. Skippy ripped away the tape, and they began taking out the papers about this newest secret. Skippy read, "That's not the way the world really works anymore. We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. And while you are studying that reality judiciously, as you will, we'll act again, creating other new realities, which you can study too, and that's how things will sort out. We're history's actors, and you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do." Karl Rove.
The child left behind read, "The so-called lone nut, mind-controlled gunmen who kill Americans every year are, in general, not acting alone. Time after time, reports of more than one gunman involved in such shootings are suppressed by the mainstream media, whether it be the Las Vegas incident or the Florida school shooting. These are covert false flag operations that have only one purpose, to build pressure in the direction of banning guns. While the oligarchy or the elite wants to take guns away from the citizenry, the civilian law enforcement is being militarized with rocket launchers, armored vehicles, and military gear. One may ask, why? The Florida shooting appears to have been a very complicated staged media event with operators and contributors coming from the Democratic National Party, local law enforcement, military, the county school board, the FBI, and Secret Service. No doubt this staged media event involves millions of dollars in bribes, payoffs, and fees. A Parkland, Florida, Stoneman Douglas High School teacher says the school had been told there would be a code red drill. When he heard shooting, he assumed it was the drill. What is so difficult about the authorities and the media explaining either that the teacher and students misunderstood and are mistaken that a drill had been announced, or alternatively, explaining why there are several instances of an actual event occurring simultaneously with an announced drill? A person would think that the print and TV media would find a very interesting subject in real events occurring simultaneously with drills of the events, including apparently 9/11 itself and how facts are known in advance of the actual event. Instead, once again, we get a pre-prepared story. In this one timeline, problems are reminiscent of the BBC reporter standing in front of a still-standing World Trade Center Building 7 on September 11, 2001, announcing that the unexpected collapse of the building had occurred 20 or 30 minutes before the event. Many Americans are so brainwashed and so gullible that they are not capable of seeing that the evidence completely contradicts the official stories that they are fed by the authorities and the press. More irregularities in the official school shooting scenario. Secret Service shows up 2 weeks earlier to change safety protocols. schools notified in advance of an active shooter drill would take place in the near future and told it would happen without notice. The morning of the shooting, students are involved with school safety drills with law enforcement. That afternoon before the shooting began, the fire alarm is pulled and students are asked to leave the building, and then shortly after, a code red active shooter was called while the students were still being told to leave the building. Military officers, Army, are at the scene directing students to not look at dead bodies as they file past what appear to be body bags. Shooter arrives in a taxi, Uber, and just walks into the school with a gun case and materials. Shooter apparently gets set up and manages to shoot and kill 19 people in 6 minutes after arriving. Then he is able to put down weapons and blend in with the still exiting for fire drill student population. While Shooter is mixing into student body, he speaks to a friend of his from elementary school, and the friend later tells the local TV news interviewer that she was talking to the shooter while gunshots were being heard in another part of the building. This video has been taken down by YouTube. Shooter leaves no wounded, exhibiting expert marksmanship, since the AR-15 223 rounds are small and almost always produce wounded, some dying later, but not in this case. Shooter then casually walks to Walmart and eats at Subway and then shows up at McDonald's in the same area to get a drink, appearing at an intersection later just as police were arriving. Four deputies were seen watching the events unfold outside the building, not entering to stop the shooter. Was this because these men were told to stay out? Logic can easily surmise that out of four men, at least one would have responded by trying to stop the shooting. These men are all not cowards. This indicates they are in on the staged operation. Like Sandy Hook, Las Vegas, 9/11, and other false flag events, there are no releases of video footage, no photos of dead children, no autopsy reports, no hospitals reporting examining students after shooting. This deep state in the U.S. has been defined in different ways. Peter Del Scott of the University of California, Berkeley, has called it the politically active rich. That is, the people who have so much money that they are above the law, the same way the mafia or criminal underworld is below the law. These people are above the law. So they rig elections. They assassinate presidents. JFK was a notable victim, and candidates, his brother Bobby Kennedy, and senators, U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone. These people run the drug trade. The CIA dominates the world drug trade, as Professor Alfred McCoy of the University of Wisconsin proved decades ago, and he is still writing about that. So the deep state is essentially a kind of criminal gang that works with the world's wealthiest people, especially those here in the U.S., and runs the United States behind the scenes. We should also mention that they rig elections using computer election fraud.
Just then, the Bubbas in their RV, painted with a Soviet Red Star on the side, were making their way down Pennsylvania Avenue. Everyone sitting on top with weenies going on the George Foreman grill, waving to the crowd who were beginning to gather for the big dollar signs, boobs and tanks festival, and holding high their gold medals they won this past week in the ping pong Winter Olympics Quidditch competition.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving, and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Them that's got shall have, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Yes, the strong gets more while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grade. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Money you've got, lots of friends, they're crowding round your door. But when you're gone and the spending ends, they don't come round no more. Rich relations give crust of bread and such. You can help yourself, but don't take too much. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist, featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow, Monday, 6 to 8 p.m. EST, Studio B.
Travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Our next guest for the show is Frank Cordero. Frank Cordero joins us each week from Des Moines, Iowa, the Des Moines Catholic Worker. Frank is a former Catholic priest, a former federal and county jail prisoner for peace. Chuck talked to Frank earlier, and we're going to get to hear that conversation right now.
Hello, Chuck.
Hello, Frank.
Another week.
I know. They go so fast.
They do. And then when you call, I say, oh, my God, it's Thursday afternoon again. And it's the five-minute confession time. Right. So I'm doing this quick examination of conscience. What the heck can I talk about in the last week? I can tell you again that today I made a knockout snack with prime rib. It's a big chunk of meat we had in the freezer. I didn't know what it was. So I melted it, cooked it down, and before it was, by the time it was too late, one of the community members told me that was for one of our community dinners. We've been doing some changing in the freezers, and no one marked it. So it's an honest mistake, but today the people ate good with a prime rib stew. And God is good for the people at the Catholic Worker in Des Moines. So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
The news that I can't, you know, is the same as that Jess and Ruby are still whereabouts unknown. We live with that. I continue to try to keep my head above water by just letting the rhythm of the works of mercy and the periodic efforts to speak truth to powers as a way of just kind of like, this is what you do, good seasons or bad seasons. And we're anticipating a trial for trespass at the Drone Command Center this April. And I'm looking for the sun to bring new life to these old bones. And we're surprisingly, we're getting some younger people here in the last couple of weeks. So we've got actually three people who are seriously considering being members of our community who are below 30. Can you believe that? I can't believe it. It's riveting and exciting. That sort of thing. Well, you know, it's just a... It's good or bad. A life here at the Des Moines Catholic Worker is changing all the time, and the people are coming and going. It is one of the most fluid scenes as I described 40 years, we're only really not one community. We're really 40 different communities change every year. I don't know what that says, but we're very transient. Culture and these places invite that kind of fluid communal bonding and letting go. And I think that's really important. I think we need these temporary permanent communities all over the damn place so people can come and go and have space where they're actually doing the works of mercy, which is one of the things that we're commanded to do. Takes care of a lot of things, but it also puts us in a place where Americans can be serving people at a personal level without intermediates between institutions and faith denominations and government programs. And that's a valued thing to do on its own. Then you add the lifestyle, communal life, communitarian disciplines that none of us now have. In normal, healthy cultures, these are things they would teach you by the time you're 10. But whatever they taught you in this, by the time you're 10, they beat it out of you by the time you're 18. We don't know how to live in community. So it's like, you know, we have to reinvent the world, a wheel here for so many people who bring so many family of origin issues. Because that's the only family most people know, and reasonably so. And it's the only family tools people have to work with in these faith communities. So those are always very difficult in this culture. And then do resistance and go to jail, which is like the topping on the cake and something we just got to do. And if we're strong enough and healthy enough and can do it, and we've got a community that allows us to do it, God, then we're really way ahead of the curve for most people. And of course, whatever we do from the center of the empire is really always going to look pathetic. Did I tell you that?
Yeah.
Pathetic.
Yeah.
That's what we got to do. Yeah. So all that being happening, you live your life with the people who come and go. And right now I'm just trying to recover from a loss of a girlfriend. I know this story warrants a country song because it really speaks to that kind of pain. So, but I'm not that good at music, so I just have to go on. Yeah, that's what I've got to do.
Hang in there, Frank, and thank you so much.
And thank you.
Hey, we'll talk to you next time.
Okie dokie, brother. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Our next guest, Ebby Litwack, describes herself as a formerly incarcerated Jewish lesbian. Ebby, take it away.
Hi. Okay. So I will start with in 2009 and 2011, I was living with my mother who couldn't see, couldn't hear, and barely could walk. I was her 24-hour caretaker. And I had already gone to trial and had lost and knew I was heading for sentencing, and she wanted to go with me, even though it would be a terribly long drive. And she did, and she looked at the judge. She wanted to speak. She said, "Your Honor, I'm a Holocaust survivor. I have suffered enough for a lifetime. My daughter, she's been a fantastic daughter, and without her, I cannot exist. She's been doing everything for me. She feeds me. She shops. I can't exist for even a day. I will die without her." And the judge responded by saying, "Your daughter is a monster. She's hurt hundreds of people." And I wanted to kill him, not because he hurt my feelings, but because he said that in front of my mother. So I went home, and you unpack for prison. You take off your jewelry. You go to prison in just the clothes you wear. And she walked into my room, and she's about 4'9", using a walker. And she said to me, "Stand up, I have something to say to you." And so I said, "You know what?" I saw she was serious, and she said, "Prison is going to be harder for you than concentration camp was for me." And I said, "Mom, how could you? That's crazy. How could you say that? You were in Auschwitz." And she said, "I was 12 years old. You are 60. And it wasn't until I was in solitary confinement a few years later that I thought about what she said, and thought about the words. She said, "I'm 12. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't have a lot in my life. You're 60. You're an old woman, and your whole life is going to pass you by every day." And she was correct. The moment you went to prison, you know that you're no longer in the free world. An officer took me into a cold and dingy room. I had to strip naked in front of her. I had to pee in front of her. I was told to lift my breast so she could check for paraphernalia underneath. And then I had to bend over and cough while she checked to make sure I had no contraband or drugs in my vagina or my anus. And in that moment, I was more humiliated than I had ever been in my entire life. And in the first 10 seconds, I realized, as does everybody who goes through this, that you have to go into a zone you don't even know you have. You can't show your feelings. You can't cry. And you have to be a different person because this person is dangerous for you. So I went from there to the first sleeping unit I would be in, which was called the Admissions and Orientation Unit, where you spend about 2 weeks learning about the rules of prison. And the veterans walked over to me and I said, "If you want to stay under the radar, or rather, if you want to do easy time, you have to stay under the radar. And that means no officer knows your name. No, the warden doesn't know your name." Well, I was a baby of the women's movement, civil rights, gay rights. I marched against Vietnam. So I was an old, experienced radical activist. And you don't just check your activism at the door. And it took less than an hour for me to be on virtually everybody's radar. So people walk over, and this is why I was on everybody's radar. People walk over and they ask you, a first person says to you, are you married? Do you have kids? And I would say, I said, no, I'm not married. I don't have kids. Second person, third person, fourth person. And by the fourth person, I got tired of saying, no, I'm not married and I don't have kids. And I said to my friend, also, you're allowed to bring 25 pictures into prison. So I thought, you know, I came out 40 years ago to my mother. And when I came out to her, she said, if Hitler didn't kill me, you will, which I thought was pretty funny at the time. But I thought, I'm not going to just go back in the closet because I'm in prison. So the very next person that said to me, are you married? Do you have a kid? I said, I'm not married. I don't have a kid. I'm a lesbian. And the woman said, okay, and can I see your pictures? Now, anybody who knows me knows that I live with a little Maltese dog named Allie, and I brought in 25 pictures of my dog. So this woman yelled, this old woman, this old bike has 25 pictures of her dog. So that went around. Inmate.com had the word spread into the entire compound, which is roughly 1,100 women, that I am not only a lesbian, but I have 25 pictures of my dog, which people found quite amusing. So within about a week of being, I'm only in prison a week when the unit manager calls me up to her office and says, I need to talk to you. And I thought, what could I have done wrong in a week? And she looked at me and she said, I understand you are an open lesbian. And I said, I'm also an open Jew and an open feminist. And she said, it's come to my attention that you've been touching women's buttocks. And I went crazy temporarily. I didn't remember I was in prison. And I said, how dare you say something like that about me? That's absolutely false. And I want the women who made these accusations here right now. I was acting like I was in a courtroom and I was yelling at an officer. So she said, you can go out of my office now. And by the time I walked down one little flight of stairs, she had packed up my belongings and took me out of this quiet unit that I was in and put me in a unit that was called the ghetto. And she put me in a sleeping situation that was punishment. So everybody who slept, 120 women slept in one unit. And when they turn the lights off from where the women sleep, all the lights go off. Where she put me and about 19 other women was in front of the sleeping area where there were fluorescent lights on for 24 hours a day. So you're sleeping with lights on, and we are sleeping maybe 4 feet away from an ice machine, which is crashing down every 20 minutes. And on either side of where we're sleeping are the entrance to the bathrooms, where 120 women were flushing toilets and taking showers. So I was put there because I came out. Not that there weren't other lesbians, but I had the goal to come out. And at 60 years old, they normally give every woman work, so they would normally give someone a job that's easier, that's indoors, that's sweeping a little floor, and so you're able to sit and read. And what they did with me was put me, this is in West Virginia, and during the summer it's 100 degrees, they gave me a broom, and they had me sweeping big rocks off of the roads in 100 degree weather, knowing that both sides of my family had heart disease and knowing that I was a candidate for a stroke. Because we don't have a lot of time, I'm going to go in the section on medical care. There's no medical care to speak of in prison. And all they have is an x-ray machine. So if you need an MRI, a scan, if you come into prison with cancer, you're basically that you basically have a death sentence. So what happened is that there's you only get seen by a physician's assistant, and the physician's assistant sees all 1,200 women, and whether you come in with a broken foot, a migraine, a cyst, or cancer, he says the same thing to every person. And that is, you're fat, walk on the track, and drink water. So a woman named Miriam Hernandez came in. She looked like something was seriously wrong with her. He said that she's fat. He gave her the fat speech. She went back out, and 2 weeks later, she died when her gallbladder burst. And I was so upset about this that a simple blood test would have shown him that she had a gallbladder issue, and then they could have operated and taken her out, that I wrote an article and sent it out through email. Now, I was writing articles about people's cases the entire time I was in prison, and I would send it out snail mail, which was not dangerous because the officers did not read mail going out. But they do read your emails. So an hour after my article was posted on the outside, I was arrested, shackled, and thrown into solitary confinement. And solitary is a prison within a prison where the four officers who run it answer to no one. So it's filled with 60 women who are screaming, get me the fuck out of here, for 24 hours a day. And I spent 7 weeks in solitary, and to this day, I have not physically, mentally recovered from the experience. It's freezing. They keep it about 55 degrees. You're only given a t-shirt, shorts, a jumpsuit. That's it for clothes. And you have a very thin blanket and a sheet. And because it was so cold, I wore all of the clothes and the blanket and the sheet. And I begged for another blanket, and they didn't care. I had immediately from the fluorescent lights, which were on all the time, I got a terrible migraine. My blood pressure was shooting up, and I was suffering from vertigo. It took them 2 weeks to take my blood pressure, and when they took it, it was 200 over 100. And I said, are you going to take me to the hospital now? And the officer in charge said, well, we get $75,000 in insurance if you die, so no, we're not taking you there. And solitary is a cool place. They give you one roll of toilet paper. And when I ran out and asked the guard for another roll, he looked at me and said, wipe yourself. And he thought it was funny. And I couldn't cry in front of him, but I desperately wanted to. You're disoriented. You don't know what day it is. And they ended up keeping me past the time I was to be released, because they told me right out that we're going to make you pay for writing about an officer, and that whenever you write about an officer, you're going to suffer. Now, when my sentence was over, I was put on a Greyhound bus, given $30, and sent back to New York. I arrived at Port Authority to no one. My mother was in no shape to help me in any way, and my brother had sold the apartment my father had given me, and he wanted nothing to do with me, he and his family. In fact, he gave my mother Sophie's choice, that my mother could either have a relationship with me or see her grandchildren, his three children. And she was frightened that he would not allow her to have a relationship with the grandchildren. So when I came home, I would sneak out to see her so that he wouldn't see me, so that she wouldn't lose the privilege of knowing her grandchildren. Now, I'm one of 700,000 people who come home every year with no place to go. And there aren't, if you don't have a job and you can't get housing. So the two biggest issues formerly incarcerated people face are getting a job and getting housing. And when I was homeless for about 16 months, until a friend discovered my situation and helped me get into a small room in senior housing. I am 66 now. And when I was released, I was 64 years old. But I was worried because if I rented this small room, the only money I had was Social Security, and I would have no money to eat. I applied for 200 jobs, even though I had a 30-year work resume, I couldn't get a job. It was a combination of my age, probably, and my felony conviction. So my friend, seeing how difficult it was for me to get a job, said she would give me $1,000 a month for a year, and she saved my life. I would not have been able to survive without her. And because of that, I was able to start my organization, Witness to Mass Incarceration. And what I do is I am taking the history of formerly incarcerated people by interviewing them for about 6 hours and having their life be memorialized before, during, and after prison. And I've used segments, one in particular, a friend of mine who's a trans woman of color who was put in a male prison held in solitary confinement. And while she was in solitary, guys in the prison would pay the guards to let them in to sexually assault or rape her. And I show her story, and it's deeply upsetting to audiences. So Witness, which is not funded yet, I'm trying to raise money for Witness. So if you're so inclined, text Witness 83224 and help me out. Or write to me at Evie Litwock, EVIELITWOK. @gmail.com and become part of my army, and I'll send you my publications. But I want people to see what we're doing in this country with mass incarceration. And I have an initiative which is called the Suitcase Project, where I am going to groups, I'm going to synagogues, churches, mosques, and saying, help one person when they come home. Just help one person. Give them a suitcase with a cell phone with enough minutes for a year, an inexpensive one, a laptop so that they can look for a job, and money for clothes, because I came out with no clothes. And then adopt them for a year, not every day, but make sure once a month you have dinner with them so that they're connected. Because in addition to not having a job and housing, you are isolated. You're going from a world where, as horrible as it was, you knew you were going to eat. You knew you were going to sleep. But when you come out, whether it's 6 months or 20 years into the free world, so much has changed that, and it has left you behind. In a way, we can never compete for jobs because we don't know the technology. We don't know what younger people know. And so we're much worse off, which is handicapping.
We've really gone over our time here, but that was such a tremendous story. I didn't have the heart to stop you, so we're going to fit it in somehow. I love what you're doing with the Witness Project. I'm horrified by what happened to you in prison. And I hope that we can get you back on the show sometime to talk some more.
Absolutely. And if you could mention the text Witness 83224, then it's very helpful for me. I actually got that today. I have someone digitally smart who's actually helping me.
Okay.
So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Once again, that was Evie Litwock. And she was filling in tonight for Azura Crispino, our usual guest on the first Thursday of the month. Azura will hopefully be back with us next month, but I do hope that we will be able to speak to Evie again.
Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Wadia will remain a dictatorship. Be quiet. Why are you guys so anti-dictators? Imagine if America was a dictatorship. You could let 1% of the people have all the nation's wealth. You could help your rich friends get richer by cutting their taxes and bailing them out when they gamble and lose. You could ignore the needs of the poor for healthcare and education. Your media would appear free, but would secretly be controlled by one person and his family. You could wiretap phones. You could torture foreign prisoners. You could have rigged elections. You could lie about why you go to war. You could fill your prisons with one particular racial group, and no one would complain. You could use the media to scare the people into supporting policies that are against their interests.
Tune in Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, for Liberation Nation with Deacon John, where America comes to hear the truth.
I know this is hard for you Americans to imagine, but please try.
Anti-aircraft guns went into action against unidentified aircraft in the Los Angeles area shortly after 3 a.m. Pacific wartime this morning.
We are far stronger than we were 10 weeks ago.
General Quarters, all hands man your battle stations.
You're nervous, count your toes. I'll do the mastermind around here.
You who have not seen it do not know what hell looks like from the top.
Check it out every Tuesday and Saturday on Revolution Radio. It's a double dose of the internationally recognized renegade military historian, Douglas Dietrich.
You'll stay right where you are till I tell you to move out.
Yeah, that's right. Tuesdays from 10 to midnight Eastern Time. Join Douglas Dietrich as he exposes the truth in hidden history on his show, Critical Omissions. And then our human weapon of mass destruction is back once again to take your calls on Saturday night firing lines. Bolt from 10 to 12 p.m. Eastern Time. Only on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Our next guest of the show is Ava Byrd. Ava Byrd is a poet living in Southern California. Chuck visited with Ava earlier, and we're going to get to hear that conversation right about now. Ava Byrd in Los Angeles.
Hey, Chuck.
Hi, Ava. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Okay. So you're in Las Vegas, right?
Viva Las Vegas.
Hey, you were telling me about a new book that you're reading. Why don't you tell the listeners?
Okay, yeah, I'd love to. Thanks. I know you and I were talking a little bit about it earlier. It's a book. It's not necessarily more. A lot of people haven't heard about it. It's new to me in the sense that I just checked it out from the library and I'm about to read it. But it's a book. I know that Mike has heard of it, and he's probably read it. I know he's made some references to it over the years. I just actually got around to finding it at the library and checking it out. But it's a book by a man named Dave McGowan. It's McGowan, the late Dave McGowan. And he wrote a book. He's actually written several books. This one is called Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. And it's about the Laurel Canyon music scene of the 60s and early 70s that produced most of the music that was really well loved, and it set the stage for the 60s and 70s, the hippies and all that. It's actually started there in Laurel Canyon, which is in Los Angeles, not too far from Beverly Hills and the West Side. It's basically the Hollywood Hills. It's wooded. It's actually a very nice community. You feel like you're in the woods or in the degree, but that's where Jim Morrison, the Byrds, the Turtles, the Mamas and the Pops, David Crosby, Graham Nash, pretty much all of the from the 60s, they all lived there, meaning they all lived and performed in that area. They had one thing in common. Most of them had one, is that their fathers or parents came from high level military intelligence backgrounds. So some people would write that off as a coincidence, but when you really dig deep into some of the really odd parallels, like Jim Morrison's father had called in the Gulf of Tonkin incident. He was the one that actually called that in, which was somewhat to do with the escalation or the real explosion of the Vietnam War. And not even a year after that, Jim Morrison was, you know, prancing down Sunset Boulevard as like, this rock icon, having had no musical experience or even a music class or anything like that. He just kind of exploded onto the scene out of nowhere. And that was actually consistent with most of them from that scene, that they just appeared out of nowhere with little to no musical background. And all of a sudden they were these rock stars. And the thing that they had in common again was this high level military placement of their fathers and or families. That was true with Frank Zappa also. So it's really fascinating. It sheds light on how a lot of these, what we think is counterculture, is often actually part of part of a PSYOPs program that, you know, it's like a controlled opposition, or there's different ways of looking at it. But when you really dig, I mean, I know to some degree it sounds, you know, ridiculous, or it sounds like you're really stretching for, you know, things to make connections with. But when you really dig into it, the parallels are way beyond coincidence and actually spookily shocking to uncover. And the reason that this is so interesting to myself and probably other people is because that music really defined a generation and a whole era, and to some degree, you know, the whole century. It really influenced a whole century of that type of music. And you know, there's speculation that the CIA was actually the one that put LSD and you know, put that into that scene there to create the chaos and to create all of which was created. So anyway, I just wanted to share that with the listeners. It's a very good book. Again, you can get it on, I think you can order it from the guy's website, just as an interesting, or not necessarily interesting, but kind of a tragic side note to this, is that the author, David McGowan, actually tragically passed away just a couple of months, or maybe not even a year, after the publishing of the book. And he was healthy before, and all of a sudden he had this very rare form of lung cancer that just ended up rapidly killing him just within a few months after the book was published. So that's even more, you know, more to go on there. But so again, it's a Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, really fascinating. Anyway, I think Chuck would love it. And I'm sure Mike's probably already read it. If he hasn't, I think you guys would both love it. And listeners too. And I actually did hear on Revolution Radio, the show that you're the network that your show, the show, Chuck and Mike, The New American Dream, is broadcast on. They did actually interview that author, Dave McGowan, for the book a couple of times. I found that on YouTube, or on the, it's on one of the talks. So you can listen to that for free. He talks a lot about it. If you don't want to get the book, or don't want to read the book, he goes into a lot of the details about it in his talks. So anyway, thank you for letting me talk about that. And I know in a couple hours, Chuck is going to be totally immersed in learning about this. It's really pretty fascinating. Just one more point I want to make about it that, I find kind of funny is that in those days, often people would pick these favorite. Oh, I have my 10 favorite guitarists, you know, one from the Byrds, one from the Turtles, one from the Doors. And as it turns out, what they figured out is all of these musicians that had exploded on that scene and that had albums, you know, they got recording contracts and, you know, tours and things like that, that are relatively not that easy to come by as a new artist in LA or really anywhere. But they all of a sudden, all of them got these recording contracts. And as it turns out, they had studio musicians actually recording the albums that other people got credit for. And then when people went to see them live, those bands, they would comment that they didn't really sound good. And the reason that they didn't sound good is because the guys playing the music weren't the ones that recorded it and weren't musicians, professional musicians. So that came to light there. And if you notice, a lot of that music, it was good. A lot of it did sound the same. It had a similar sound. That's because the same musicians, the same studio musicians, were playing on the same album. So if you wondered where that 60s sound came from, that could be one explanation. But not to say that it wasn't good. I mean, we all, you know, that was some of the best music that a lot of us have ever heard, and it influenced a lot of people, and to this day is still influencing musicians and cultures. And just one more point I just wanted to make too, that I know Charles Manson recently passed away, and he was a big part, or at least a part of that Laurel Canyon scene, that people knew him, and you know, he had played and partied with a lot of the people there, Neil Young, and also the Beach Boys. They had used one of his songs and changed the title and changed some of it. So they actually used one of Charles Manson's songs. Didn't give him credit, I don't think. But, you know, there's some really kind of shocking connections that are really, you know, way beyond just mere coincidences, and that are, it's just after the fact, you know, 40, 50 years later, it's interesting, but.
I'm definitely going to look for it.
Okay.
Okay. So let's hear a poem.
Okay. This one is called Big Winds. Big Winds. Big games winning, winning it big, winning through beating the odds, and winning anyway. Those points scored, score those points, bitch, by any means necessary. Win it big, win it all, and smile and go home. Do the basics again, breathing and being, breathing and releasing, letting go of the time. Sit in lotus. Sit up straight, smile, or at least focus. Confront that monkey mind again. Shit happens, man. Girls rising. She's getting fed up with the BS of all of this, this ridiculousness. This isn't her nature. Military and bombs and guns and bombs and gods and gods and drugs and silly nuclear silly religions and invisible man in the sky, the hierarchies and races. And OMG, WTF, I mean, come on, man. We can get it together. We can save the planet. She saves us, after all. She gives birth to our life and seeds and hosts our oceans. I mean, come on again. Let's get it together. If not for ourselves, not a jerk-off fest, how about something more useful? Generous giving. This is just basic stuff. Just the survival of the smartest and kindest. But cleaning the water, cleaning the air, and eating good, clean, real food. These are the basics that we need to have now. Now by now, we should be way ahead. We could just be there now. If we did, imagine, if we lived there, we'd be home by now.
Thank you so much, Op.
You're welcome. That was called Big Winds again. And again, thanks for listening to my brain wrapped up in that book, and that whole scene there, it hits close to home for me, because I'm really close to there and have lived in that neighborhood before and never heard of any of this stuff.
Wow.
So yeah, it's just so interesting. I mean, even if you don't live there, we've all that music has touched our lives at some point.
Absolutely. Yep.
So yeah.
Thanks so much for sharing it. And that was a great poem, and so appropriate for being in Las Vegas.
That's right. It is appropriate. And I'm winning big, not through gambling and not with money. Other currencies are available besides just money. We're all winning big.
Yes, indeed. Thanks again. We'll talk to you next month.
Okay, I'll have more poetry. And let's all go out there and win big. Thanks again.
Hey, okay, great. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Our next guest of the show is Mickey Z. Mickey Z is a writer, an activist, a poet living in New York City. He lives in Queens, Astoria, New York City. And Chuck visited with Mickey earlier, and we're going to hear that conversation right now. Mickey Z in New York City.
Well, I think February was an exceptionally short month this year. We're already up to March, and the good thing about that is it's time to talk to Mickey Zezima, our columnist from Astoria, New York City. Welcome to the show, Mick.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's always good to be here.
Yeah, so well, what's going on up there? Anything significant that we should know about?
You mean in New York City?
Yeah. I know nothing ever happens there, you know, but
yeah. You know, you're asking someone who navigates the city on a daily basis, so I would answer almost in what would sound like mundane ways, where that the weather today warmed up, which, you know, it's this time of year can be quite cold in New York. So there was some sun in the 50s. And in less exciting news, every time you think that the New York City subways can't be run less efficiently than they are, they find a new level to sink to. It seems like in all my years of living in New York City, I'd have to go really far back to New York's bankrupt days and all to find a time period when the subways were this much of the talk of the town in a negative way.
Wow, really? What's so bad about them?
Obviously, it's such an old system that was not built to handle this many people on a daily basis. But it's also like most aspects of American society, because it serves, it's like a public service and funded by taxes and so on. It gets the short end of the stick in terms of funding. You know, they're always saying they're out of money. They have to raise the fares and they do repairs. When they schedule the repairs to get places in New York City, it becomes almost impossible. Like what would be maybe one train for a 20-minute ride, you wind up changing two or three times and it takes an hour. And so it's like, it's kind of the same story everywhere else. Like the funding goes to the people who paid for the campaigns and so on.
Right.
And the rest of us don't get the funding. So it's kind of that old story, but just imagine putting that onto a over 100-year-old transportation system, and you could see that it's a recipe for a disaster.
Well, at least you have a transportation system.
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Let me back up and say that I deeply appreciate it. As a New Yorker, like, I don't own a car, and I'm able to walk or take the subway everywhere. And it's a good reminder to not take that for granted, because it really is convenient in that sense.
Yeah, okay. They're talking about making some kind of changes around here with public transportation, but they're not really making very good choices. And I think hopefully it'll get killed before they spend too much money on it. But I don't know. We need something, but what we don't need, like old fashioned, streetcars. I don't think that makes much sense.
Wow.
Anyhow, the big news down here, of course, is just in our county, we had that big shooting out at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. And one of our frequent guests on the show, Rachel Finley, her son attends that school.
Wow.
Her son's wrestling coach got killed, and he had been sitting with the wrestling coach about an hour before the shooting. So, I mean, that's like a really close connection.
Wow. How's the boy doing?
He's holding up. I'll tell you, the kids at that school are really impressing me with what they're doing and how they've reacted. They're really trying to find something positive out of this situation and to make some changes.
Yeah. You and I have talked many, many interviews about the whole paradigm of activism. And I've been a long believer that what we need is fresh new voices, but also fresh new tactics. So I'm hoping that these kids, they're initially following the template of what people do when they're activists. But I'm hoping that because they haven't been doing this for years or even decades, that they're going to be the ones that could inspire new ideas. I mean, it's in the past six, maybe a little more months with the Me Too movement, I've seen things happen and powerful men brought down that I thought I'd never see in my lifetime. So I'm going to remain positive. I mean, I don't want to be the party pooper. I hope that the kids don't get funneled into the same old activism, because we know already that's done nothing to help the guns issue. You know, the same debates, the same petitions, the same candlelight vigils, everything has a place, but we need new ideas. So I'm hopeful that every time a batch of new, young, and super motivated and passionate people come into any realm of awareness, that they're going to see things that, you know, you and I can't, and hopefully they won't be usurped or co-opted by local activist groups, because local activist groups should be lining up behind these kids and saying, you lead, you tell us what to do, as opposed to saying, here's how you do it, because there's no activist group in America that should be telling anyone, here's how you do it. If they want to add bodies to a movement, more power to you. Then we need bodies, we need voices. But my biggest hope right now is that this can blossom in a way that we didn't see coming, and comparing it to the Me Too movement, which nobody saw that coming, where suddenly there was a unity and an awareness where these predatory men are literally running scared. And I want to see that continue. And I want to see these politicians taking money and turning their back and with the whole gun issue, and see them running scared too, because it's too many images of kids running scared in schools, literally, that I'm really hoping that this could be the catalyst, that in the realm of the Harvey Weinstein thing, where we just needed one unexpected spark, and then things take off. So that's what I'm really, really hoping for, and I'll be watching closely.
Yeah, I agree. Getting to actually speak on the floor of the State House is something that activists usually don't. It's an opportunity activists usually don't have. So they've already done some things that are out of the mold.
Yes, absolutely. And I feel like that whatever it is that they're doing, in an abstract sense too, is inspiring companies like corporations to say, not that they're suddenly moral, but their bottom line could be affected by any connection to the NRA. And I'm seeing on my newsfeed stories about corporations severing ties with the NRA.
Yes,
and indeed. I feel like, and I feel again, that's analogous to the Me Too aspect, where suddenly nobody wanted to work with Kevin Spacey, for example, and they literally like erased him from a movie and put someone else in it. And you're saying, well, now nobody wants to be within, you know, a mile of the NRA. And I think maybe these kids, like just putting faces to this nightmare that we've witnessed literally every single day. It's such a fascinating concept that you never know which group of victims, so to speak, are going to be the ones that can catalyze. And maybe we're witnessing, you know, you don't know what the turning point till some time has passed, but we might be right now living through a turning point. And after last year with the sexual abuse and harassment, and now this year with the guns, I'm just sitting back and wishing for the best, because I certainly don't have any power to impact it, but I certainly am rooting for them.
Hey, this has been very interesting, and if we talk about guns again, probably the next time we need to talk about whether taking them away threatens any rights and so forth, because there are an awful lot of people on that kind of side of the issue, as it were. No, it's definitely it has to be discussed along with everything else.
I agree. Yeah, I'm definitely. There are aspects of this that feel black and white, and then there are major aspects of it that are very gray. And I hope we can address the black and white parts first, because obviously that's a little easier. And then the nuances is stuff that's going to be a slow process of give and take. But in the short term, excited for this new momentum and focus that I don't want to get over optimistic or overextend myself, but it seems like there's a chance that it's not going to be the same old from the activists that they've learned from mistakes in the past. And this could be a time of change.
I'm hoping so. All right. Thanks so
same
much.
Here.
Talk to you next time.
Thanks so much. Have a good one.
Bye-bye. was Mickey Z from Astoria, New York City. Coming up in our next half hour, the news from Moonrock Lake, Ohio.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow, Monday, 6 to 8 p.m. EST, Studio B.
And bank annihilation. Bitcoin, Litecoin, MyCoin, YourCoin, Blockchain, baby. Mondays at 1600 hours Eastern Studio A.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, it's been another long week in Moonrock Lake, Ohio, at the end of the empire. The American dream has dangled before our eyes for over 200 years. The American dream is the goal that we Americans hold on to when everything else is gone. The American dream is our ideal. Too bad it's just a dream. The Americans dream of marshmallow clouds and lollipop lanes and TV towns, while the world wails, fist clenched, eyes blazing, tears streaming. The Americans dream of rocket ships, fireworks, freedom, and alleluia, while they sleep on through the alarm, the house of fire. We pick up our story after Michael M., staff member at Sun God Group Home, has sped off on his moped to tell the people at the workshop that there's a sit-down strike taking place in the Sun God driveway by residents refusing to go to work at the workshop, and they might be a little late. On his way, he swerved to miss a little girl, jumped the curb, and rammed his blue flake helmet into a war memorial for World War II at the city park, breaking the war memorial. And now the National Guard and police have stormed the park and taken Michael M. away in a National Guard helicopter. Michael M. was in prison for having rammed World War II with a blue flake helmet, but he loves Homeland, and all he really wants to do is get free so he can get registered for the Home Helper Show drawing and make his wife proud and his children happy. Due to the kindness of another prisoner donating his own teeth to bribe the guards, M. was then free and wandering the countryside, a wanted man known as the Big Evil One, only wanting to find a way to get registered for the Home Helper Show. Then he somehow found his way to the very home of the big man in town and his little daughter, who he almost killed, but did not, and then got taken away to prison. The big man in town agreed to help M get registered for the Home Helper Show if M will first do something for him. After the parade, Michael M. has escaped the cage in the machine shed and made his way across town to his own home, where he sees his neighbors lined up on the sidewalk thinking about shooting him because he's evil for having rammed and broken the World War II memorial in the park with his blue flake helmet and his moped. M escapes his neighbors, cutting across lawns, coming to a lemonade stand where he buys lemonade, then hurries on through town, the big evil one, pursued by friends and family, wanting to find a way to get registered for the Home Helper Show to make his wife happy and his kids proud. And finally, we come to the big drawing to see who will get on the Home Helper Show and make their wives proud and their children happy. Everyone is there. Dick and Jane, the Home Helper Show cast. John the Baptist, who got his name from micturating on the flowers around town, watches the people go by his house from his underground basement window, angry, wanting to blow them all away with a flush of his toilet if he only could. He would. The morning of the Homeland Home Helper Show drawing ceremony dawned with one gray, fluffy cloud in the sky. Come, Spot, come. Dick patted his thigh to coax his dog into the garage. Spot looked Dick in the eye and squatted in the front lawn. No, Spot, no, said Dick. He waited for Spot to finish and held the side garage door open for the dog to trot inside. Then he walked out to his lawn with a clean, fresh baggie. Rosie the Riveter sat at the breakfast table with the others, a cell phone to her ear, putting the network into motion. M sat in the quiet stillness of a forgotten boxcar on an offline spur on the west side. He sat against the wall in a corner, enjoying the morning sun, the half-open sliding door, reading an old paper. He was boiling his water for coffee in a tin can and trying not to even look at the pack of rolls he'd retrieved from the bakery dumpster the night before. His plan was to wait for the coffee. Em tried on the charcoal gray felt hat with gray band and only a small hole at the top that he'd found on a recent night walk around the east side. He arranged the top crease just right with his thumb and first two fingers. He slipped out one roll from the pack, shoved it all into his mouth, and sat back with his head against the boxcar wall, then licked his fingers in turn. He sang out loud, "A little dab will do you." From all directions, all the sidewalks, the alleys and streets, streams of people moved toward the Homeland Elementary School gymnasium. Kids rode bikes, old people shuffled along on walkers tricked out with tennis balls. Farmers drove into town in pickups and three-wheelers. Young couples hustled along pushing double and triple-wide strollers. M climbed down from the boxcar after straightening his paper bag bed, washing out his cup and tin, and burning his garbage.
Dick and Jane arrived at the elementary school outside kitchen door. Inside, they were introduced to the lovely young home helper show cast. Dick and Jane crouched and fired four pointer fingers at the cast members. They chattered in the kitchen amid bun boxes and 50-gallon trays of mac and cheese and weenie casserole, waiting for the time to make their entrance. M joined the sidewalk brigade wearing his new hat. At the front walk entrance, where all the streams came together, he saw his wife and children headed inside. He fell in behind, followed them into the gymnasium, filled with about a million gray metal folding chairs. They found seats in the middle and followed them as if they were together and slipped into the row right behind. Rosie marched down the sidewalk with Sandra, Teresa, Joseph, Crystal, and Mickey. Other members of their troop joined them at each intersection. At 10 a.m., the elementary school principal, Carol Soup Campbell, checked her wristwatch against the clock on the kitchen wall above the three-compartment sink. "Shall we?" She smiled at Dick and Jane and the lovely young cast checking their makeup in the stainless steel refrigerator, and guided them out of the kitchen across the lunchroom to the door in the hall that led to the stage. Soup put up one finger that meant just 1 minute, please. She went through the door to check the crowd and the seating arrangements and the podium and stuff. She nodded to the new band director, who raised his chin in turn, then tapped on a music stand. 1, 2, 3. He waved his baton and the band jumped into the up-tempo Homeland Helper Show theme music. The principal hurried back to open the door. She smiled and waved the lovely cast and the mayor and wife inside. As they walked onto the stage, the crowd stood to clap and cheer. For several moments, the cast and crowd crouched and pointed pointer fingers back and forth. Rosie and her group stood for a while in the back and then dispersed. The band played the national anthem and the principal led the crowd in Our Sun God. She then introduced each of the cast members in turn to the squeals and snapshots and screams of the crowd and the press. H-O-M-E-L-A-N-D! The cast members led the crowd in a pep rally, each holding up a letter glued with their publicity photo on a piece of hardboard. "And now," began one of the lovely young male cast members, "your newly re-elected mayor, Dick Heavens!" "Oh, my!" Dick took the microphone. "Thank you, Tommy. And thank you," he crouched and pointed a finger at the crowd. "All of you gathered right here today and also those everywhere in radio and television land." He pointed at one of the TV cameras and the local radio announcer in the front row. "And most of all, thank you, thank you, thank you to those who have taken the time for their busy work week to register for the Homeland Home Helper Show segment drawing." He raised a clenched fist and the crowd rose and clapped their hands over their heads. "This fall," Dick began, and the crowd stood again to cheer. He bid them to sit with an open hand pressed gently downward. "This fall, the Home Helper Show is coming to Homeland." The crowd stood and cheered. "To film a special." And again all stood. "This is an all-American city, the all-American town. This is why they are coming here. We are the American dream. We live in the American dream. The American dream is what we are about. It's what allows us to keep going." He looked down stepped slightly forward and lowered his voice. They will not stop us. They want to paralyze us. We will improve our lives. We will water. We will mow. We will get better and better and better. Yeah! Dick put a finger into the air. The crowd clapped and yelled and stomped their feet. Em also stood and clapped and stomped and yelled. His little girl looked back at him over her mother's shoulder and waved. Em waved back. Dick! 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 They chanted. And he raised a finger again to quiet the people. The epitome of the American dream is the American home! Yay, Dick! And a pool, and a larger kitchen, and another bathroom downstairs. Yay! And now, it's time to find out just what Homeland American family is going to be on the Home Helper Show this fall. Jane? Jane stepped up, and Dick handed her the microphone. Jane! 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 The crowd remained standing to chant. The HH cast pushed out a giant triple-piece see-through toaster on wheels filled with the thousands of hopeful registration cards, just waiting to identify the host family for the house makeover. Jane grabbed the handle and rolled it over and over. The crowd stopped chanting and clapping and stood mute. Hands over mouths and hearts, unable to breathe. Jane stopped the toaster from rolling. The massive cards flopped one last time. Someone dropped car keys. A baby cried out. A dog barked outside, and somewhere the school custodians complained to each other about something. Jane opened the gate. She shoved her hand into the cards and kept tunneling up to her shoulder. She came out with one card in her hand and held it above her head. Jane came to the very front of the stage, stood straight and blonde. She held the microphone and the card in front of her face. She smiled. She read the card. She ceased smiling. Said Jane. She looked back at Dick. He nodded to her to hurry the fuck up. Jane put the microphone closer to her mouth. Michael M., she mumbled. Mrs. M.? What? What did she say? Who? Speak up. Come on, Jane. Who won? The Michael M. family. The M's are the winner, she shouted. Mrs. M. swayed and nearly fell as the crowd hummed, sighed, moaned, and sat in turn. Well, he's not here. Dick moved up to stand next to Jane. He took the microphone from Jane. He has to be here to be eligible. Official rules. He's not here. We'll draw again. Jane? He took Jane's hand to bring her back to the toaster. I am. Here. M stood and removed his gray felt hat. His family looked back at him. His wife turned away, facing the stage. His daughter reached out to him. He stretched to hold her little hand. M's wife stood and turned around again, shoving aside a metal folding chair with her foot so he could come up and stand with his family. We are here. He grabbed his wife's hand and raised it. M picked up his children, one on his shoulders, the other in one arm. He gripped his wife's sweaty hand with the other. They walked down the row, then up the center aisle. Their steps and their breathing echoed in the gym. They climbed the stairs to the stage and stood gleaming with the Home Helper cast and Dick and Jane. The television cameras zoomed. Photographers clicked and flashed. The band played the Home Helper theme music. The cast moved the M family in between Dick and Jane, their arms around each other. They all crouched and pointed fingers at the cameras and crowd. The principal retrieved the microphone from Dick's limp hand and began to thank everyone for coming. Make sure to watch The Home Helper this fall. But just then the music stopped in mid-measure. Four men with Down syndrome, wearing green and black camouflage fatigues and orange face paint, appeared behind the group on stage. The men held toy black and green automatic weapons and paintball guns pointed at Dick and Jane and the others. More of Rosie's friends appeared at the back and side doors blocking egress. A door opened and slammed. Rosie the Riveter promenaded in from the cafeteria door slowly, smiling, wearing a cocked black beret. Her t-shirt featured the black outline of M's profile, sporting a sparse beard and beret. Rosie sauntered up with a WWF swagger and smirk, and her t-shirt was rolled up to her shoulder. She held up her arm and posed, showing her muscle. Thank you, she said, removing the microphone from the principal's hand. Rosie stepped in front of the onstage group to address the crowd, stuck to their metal chairs by freeze-dried sweat. Good morning! Greetings! Hola! The American dream indeed, oh Jesus. Set your alarm. Wake up! She looked left and right and down and to the back, smiling and waving at relatives, then gritted her teeth. You! She pointed at people she knew. A woman checker from the grocery, the bank teller, the football assistant coach. Do something! Hey! The crowd jumped back in their seats and pulled their hands to their chests. Americans are guilty as sin, says the Nuremberg thing, for not doing anything. Bank accounts, people starving, guilty. Stealing, guilty. Lying, guilty. War, murder, greed, ignorance, guilty, guilty. Apathy. Should I go on? Yes, yelled two people in the back. Silence. Rosie took a deep breath and looked toward the rear open door. And now we will ask the big, dark, handsome United Nations soccer player soldiers in those robin's egg blue helmets waiting in the troop carrier surrounding this block. Please come in and take these freaking Americans away out of our sight to trial, to prison, to exile, to cry. Some to commit suicide, no doubt. Some most surely. To execution. She held the microphone at her side and watched the back door. The crowd sat silent. Freedom fizz ran in a stream down the middle aisle. Someone coughed, someone could be heard crying while searching for her keys in her big purse. Dick inched away toward the door. A man named Marvin, wearing gray and blue face paint and a Dallas Cowboy stocking cap, shoved a toy AK-47 into his stomach, said, I don't think so. Rosie watched the back door without expression, stone-faced. She dropped the microphone to the floor, sending a chilling echo squeaking through the giant room. We're going to be tortured, screamed a woman to her husband. Oh, brother, said Rosie. What a bunch of retards. Go F yourselves. She nodded to her people on the stage and at the doors, and they melted away. M squeezed his wife's shoulders tightly and kissed her on the lips, then crouched down to hug his kids. A dog barked down the street, the yips drifting in through the open back door of the gym. A few school custodians reached for long brooms, and Principal Campbell began to whisper in the ears of the Homeland Helper cast that she would like to take them all out to lunch. With clenched fists held high above her head, Rosie marched to the end of the stage, down the steps, up the center aisle, and out the back door. Dick and Jane walked over and stood behind Soup Campbell until the principal invited them along to Penelope's. Rosie met with her comrades in the parking lot across from the elementary. They exchanged knuckle taps and walked together toward the gas station on the highway for supersized sodas. Dark clouds rolled in, almost rubbing their bellies on the treetops. Michael M., his wife, and kids were getting their t-shirts autographed by the home helper cast. The janitors had divided the gym into six for cleanup duty. They stood in the back, leaning on their brooms and staring at people to make them leave. Pastor Steve Cash ushered his family out with both arms, heading up the middle aisle of the elementary school gym. John the Baptist switched off his radio, walked into the bathroom, did his business, and flushed. A man sitting on his haunches in the sun on Main Street jerked his head in the direction of the school. A helicopter pushed off from the landing pad at Gitmo's. The driver of a minivan on the highway pointed out to his family a black cloud pouring from the elm trees in the middle of homeland. Neighbor ladies visiting out of doors in the Freedom and Liberty area held up their arms to dodge a falling walker, a baby doll, a huge stroller, a bent car hood, and the bottom plate of a denture. Burning chunks like toddler steaks on a backyard grill splashed sizzling into the city pool. Bits of brick and mortar and metal and wood rained back down upon the earth all around the bookstore, the jail, the dentist office. Workers hurried outside to look up into the sky, squinting against the pelting droplets. Lightning cracked, and the flagpole atop Sun God Reformed Church toppled, taking off a corner of the building. The clean white flag plopped into a puddle of mud. A siren cried. It wavered, wailed, howled, and echoed, bouncing off the buildings, running up and down the hot cement roads, around the homes, through the backyards, searching for the children. Mothers on the east side and the west side counted heads inside their frazzled brains. They wiped hands down aprons, preparing to spring into action. An owl hooted at seeing a motley cat leap over a yawning lion. The raptor horn atop the community center screamed out bloody murder. The train whistle tooted. The blood and molten bone poured from the elementary school gym into the scorched cement street like strawberry ice cream. Above the town, behind the post office, across the alley from the library, the sun shone down on Homeland's water tower. It was a shaft of pure light. Jacob's ladder, by which they could almost reach paradise. A group of second graders looked down from the walkway, watching the burning elementary school. They stood, gripping the railing, buckets of dripping red paint and brushes at their feet, paint in their hair, on their arms and faces and clothes. Behind them, the newly painted shiny gray water tower had just received another coat. No war. And that's the news from Moon Rock Lake, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the journalists and Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security, COINTELPRO, lone gunmen are about average. And that just about wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We're here every Thursday from 8 to 10 p.m., and we hope that you'll be here next Thursday and every Thursday to listen to us. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
www.freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Take a look around, kid. What do you see? Homes being foreclosed. People working 2-3 jobs just to put food on the table and still drowning in debt. Don't get me wrong. This country was founded on great ideals and principles. They've all been ruined by the banks. Open your eyes to the banks that are robbing you. You know who my favorite president was?
Who?
Thomas Jefferson. Because he saw all of this coming and tried to stop it. He fought the banks. JFK too, and they killed him for it. The banking institution is more dangerous than an army, he said. He also said that every generation needs a revolution, Jimmy. The American dream is just that. Just a dream. War is a continuation of politics, only by other means. Politics is a continuation of economics by other means. This is our bank. This is our war. And this is our plan of attack.
Banks have become an essential threat to our democracy. So consider this justice.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio!
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning, warning.
We gotta stop them. They're gonna kill us all.
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone. Or human beings.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so obvious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves